You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adams way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 163. And with me tonight, I have a terrific cast of accomplished ladies who are going to help you all understand what women are doing in nuclear. The motivation for me having this call was I just returned from a very well-organized and energetic and invigorating conference in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, called the Region 2 Women in Nuclear Conference. I learned a lot and got re-energized about my own nuclear professionalism. So tonight we have Meredith Angwin, who blogs at Yes Vermont Yankee,
Hi,
Julie Easold, Gwyneth Cravens, and Margaret Harding, and I'll let you each introduce yourself and give yourself a little plug for what you're doing.
I started out by interrupting you. That isn't much of a plug. I just thought I was going to say hi there. This is Meredith Angwin. I blog at Yes Vermont Yankee, and I also, about 6 months ago, started the Ethan Allen Institute Energy Education Project to have a not-for-profit that was able to educate people about where electricity really comes from and the role of nuclear, especially Vermont Yankee, in providing electricity in this neck of the woods, that is Vermont and New England. And that's basically it.
Very good. Julie?
My name is Julie Easel. I'm a nuclear engineer at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory, and I'm responsible for the California 252 program. And in my free time, I enjoy going out and doing educational outreach, and I've covered every age from kindergarten through faculty at nuclear engineering departments.
Free time? I thought that you didn't have much free time.
Tell me, it's tough. I'll tell you that much.
Gwyneth?
Well, my name is Gwyneth Cravens, and I have a master's degree in English literature. And I was opposed to nuclear power until about 10 years ago when I began to be educated about it. And I wound up writing a book called Power to Save the World, The Truth About Nuclear Energy.
And Margaret?
And I'm a nuke from, I've been working in the nuclear field for 30 years this year. Graduated with a degree in nuclear engineering from Iowa State back in 1981.
A very good year.
Yes. And, you know, people, I was from a small town in Iowa and, wanted to do something that made a difference in the world. And I had come out of high school not long after, two bouts of oil embargoes and, saw nuclear power as a way to change the equation. At that time, a lot of power in this country was actually generated using oil. So being just nuclear was an interesting field, and I ended up in it. So 30 years, I spent 28 working for big corps, and for the last 2 years, I've been doing a year and a half or so, been doing my own thing as an independent consultant and having a ball.
Very good. Oh, I'm getting an echo. I wonder if Margaret, can you put yours on mute?
Yeah. I'll mute when I'm not talking.
Okay. Is that better? Yeah, I think that's probably the source of
it. Is it my phone sometimes?
No.
I don't have my headphones on, so there's a little feedback going on. So I kill my mic when I'm not talking, and we'll be fine.
Very good. Yeah, your story and mine are very similar. I actually started the nuclear business in 1981 as well, although it wasn't really business. It was military, because I also was formed by the Arab oil embargoes. The first one occurred when I was just really getting excited about having wheels and learning to drive. And damn, I thought that we weren't going to be able to drive at all. Gasoline went from a quarter to 75 cents a gallon in the space of a year.
Yeah, I remember that well. We were driving. We went to visit my brother, who was stationed at the Presidio in San Francisco. And so we drove from Iowa to San Francisco, and being a budding engineer even back then, I kept a journal, and I kept track of the miles per gallon and how fast and how much gas cost at each stop and each driver between my mom and my dad and my older brother. And the price of gas kept climbing, and I thought, oh, my God, we're going west, and, wow, gas is getting more expensive. And as we came home, it continued to climb, and, wow.
That was an interesting round trip, I'm sure.
Yeah, it got a lot more expensive by the end.
And you point out something very interesting. One of the common misconceptions about electrical power production is that we don't use oil in it, which is not really a misconception now, but there's a good reason why we went from having 17% of our electricity being produced by oil in 1978 to a point where we're almost zero today. What captured that market share?
Let me think. Nuclear!
Yeah, full nuclear engineers on here, looks like.
No, that... And I grew up in South Florida, where Florida Power and Light Company was actually one of the largest consumers of oil in the country at that time, because it was really easy to load heavy oil onto a ship in Venezuela and barge and, you know, make haste to South Florida. It was the easiest way for Florida to get its fuel, because it was a lot cheaper to move oil that way than to move coal from somewhere else. My dad figured out how to move coal to Florida. You build the coal plant in northern Georgia, and you build a 500 kVA transmission line from northern Georgia down to South Florida. He was the guy who was in charge of building the substations for the transmission line. Uh-huh. Coal by wire.
It works.
Yes. Okay, so... Julie, tell me a little bit about what it's like to go and teach Girl Scouts about nuclear energy.
I haven't done Girl Scouts as much. I've done probably everybody but Girl Scouts, to be honest. Girl Scouts, unfortunately, don't have an atomic merit badge like a Boy Scout. They do have a science badge, and we have tailored it by using the American Museum of Science and Energy here in Oak Ridge, because they have most of the displays already set up, and then we just bring the hands-on things in. But mostly what I've done is gone out to any teacher that will let me in their classroom. I've done everything from the younger kids, second grade, you know, through the primary school, second through fifth, and then gone into high schools, where one school I actually taught the chapter on nuclear chemistry for the teacher, because she wasn't as comfortable, and she used that time to catch up on her grading, and I got to teach.
Oh, that's terrific. Yeah, that's an interesting comment, because one of the factors, I think, in a little bit of the uneducation of Americans about nuclear is it always seems like nuclear is the last chapter of the book. And the
it is the last chapter. Not only that, the first picture they see in the textbooks is a hydrogen bomb.
Absolutely. In fact, when I was in high school, I did one of the very first papers I wrote for my science teacher was on the evils of nuclear in terms of its the terrible things that the bombs do. And I did not understand that you could actually generate electricity with the same material.
No, I mean, that's the misconception that we're trying to fight.
You know, the people near Savannah River, Case Energy, CNTA, Clint Wolf is the head of it, and I know him, or he's one of the heads of it. He's not the head of it. Anyway, one of the things they do is they've had furloughs for teachers, and teachers have had to take time off and stuff because of budget cuts, and they offer teachers a one-day workshop in nuclear at, I guess, $125 or some kind of stipend for the day on a furlough day, and they've had quite a few teachers taking this class.
Now, are the teachers paying or getting paid?
They're getting paid. They're getting paid on a day that they would be late. They would be otherwise discouraged from working because of budget cuts. You'd have to look at CNTA or talk to Clint Wolf about it. But I thought, well, that is a really good idea. There is a way you can leverage some knowledge. Anyway, it just seemed wonderful.
And help the teacher put food on the table.
Right.
Okay, so now one thing we've done here locally with our American Nuclear Society is we do a one-day teacher's workshop on nuclear science that's free for the teachers. We just don't have a mechanism to pay them.
I think it's a little odd to be paying them, but he told me that they did. And now I think that it's a CNTA and it's in Savannah River area, so someone could check on this. But I'm pretty sure that he was talking about furloughs for teachers, and this is one way they got, you know, good vibes going with the teachers, you know, as well as information to the teachers.
Yeah, of course, I think that CNTA is a Citizens for Nuclear Technology Awareness. That's for. And they're a nonprofit group that is also heavily engaged in trying to bring additional projects to Savannah River.
Right.
Yeah, I know. I think I ran into Clint at the Blue Ribbon Commission when I went and testified there this summer. So, Gwyneth, I think that you just had a very whirlwind tour visiting Meredith and her fellow folks in the, Blue Mountain State? Is that what Vermont's called?
No, Green Mountain.
Green Mountain. I like blue better.
Well, they're more like white if you go there in the winter.
Okay. So tell us about that journey. What did you do?
Well, it was interesting. It was a whirlwind, and Meredith will probably have to correct me because it's sort of I gave three talks in one day, and one was at the State House where the legislature was meeting, and some legislators did attend that talk. And then the next talk was at the University of Vermont. They have an ecology institute. Meredith will be able to say the name of it. I don't remember exactly what the name is, but these were, I think, maybe grad students in the energy fields mostly, and they asked some good questions. And then the evening lecture was at the Ethan Allen Institute,
in Burlington, Sheraton.
In Burlington. Yeah. They have regular meetings with talks, and I was a speaker at one of those. And those questions were also very good, and so it's quite a spectrum from people at the State House. A young woman came up to me with a kind of comic book by an author I hadn't heard of, but who got all his information from John Goffman.
Ah, a good source of information.
Laughably out of date, and who claimed that he thought that his work with radium while he was at, I think, Lawrence Livermore, had probably shortened his life considerably.
Didn't he die in 88 or something?
89.
Okay.
I was wondering if he was still saying that when he was 89. Anyway, there's plenty of outdated, wrong information with the name of a scientist attached to it that young people glom onto because it's disseminated by various anti-nuclear organizations. I'm not going to call them environmental organizations. I decided that, I think along with some others, that we cannot call an organization environmental if it opposes the only large-scale, clean way to produce electricity without burning hydrocarbons.
Hey Gwyneth, I think I'm going to try your other line, if you don't mind. So I'm going to hang you up and try your landline.
Okay.
Back to where we were.
I wanted to put in my two bits about something that was talked about earlier, if I may. I am so happy that all of you nuclear engineers and Meredith, a chemist in the energy field, are doing educational outreach. And I was remembering when I was a Girl Scout and a kid in grade school and so on, and scientists from the Sandia National Labs would come and talk to the classrooms and talk to, you know, come to scout meetings, or scouts would be invited to go to Sandia National Labs and play with Geiger counters and stuff. And that laid the groundwork for me for the book I wrote when I was, many decades later, because I had had a little taste of science, even though I went on to become an English major.
Hey, there's and nothing wrong with being an English major.
Well, no, I know. Of course not, Rod. Fellow English major. But I am so pleased that about educational outreach, I think it's the way to make sure that upcoming generations are more comfortable with nuclear power because they have the right information. I think one of the offshoots of the environmental movement was that science teachers could get a degree in ecology, which is could be a hard science, but can be a soft science, about recycling and Mother Nature and not having atomic energy and things like that. And I know Richard Rhodes thinks that's one reason for the negativity, rising negativity about nuclear power generally, is the way science classes are often taught by people who came out of the environmental movement part of their, college education. So what you're doing is great, and I applaud you.
I can add one more thing, if you don't mind. Rod, I just got back from going to Meigs County Middle School today to present a check for $5,000 for STEM activities. Working for a Battelle company, that is an expectation, and the discovery of element 117, we were awarded a Gordon Battelle Scientific Discovery Award, and we got to choose which school got that check. And Meigs County is a very rural, really rural, school about 50 miles south of Oak Ridge, and they did a full school assembly, and the kids all gave us a standing ovation when we presented the check.
Yeah, I'm sure that kind of money makes a big difference in a school like that. You know, sometimes I wonder, in terms of science education, one of the things that I remember very clearly was I had a whole bunch of really, really bright, talented female teachers who loved science, but part of the reason that they were teaching was that when they started their professional careers, they didn't have too many other options.
Yes, when I started my professional career, I mean, I did get jobs, but the in those days, the newspapers had help wanted male and help wanted female, and all the technical jobs were in the help wanted male thing. You sort of had to bend your mind to apply for them, and you kind of knew as you were applying that you were going to be low on the list.
Wow.
That sadly, I mean, they didn't do separate want ads, but I interviewed for jobs, obviously, as a female in a male-dominated industry. And, you know, I went to interviews where, of course, I was in a skirt and heels and, you know, I was dressed up for an interview. And the first thing the guy says to me is, "I hope you don't think you're going to wear those on a plant site." And the other story I have to tell is I interviewed, and it was actually with the company I ended up working for, but I knew this guy was a bit of an anomaly, and there's a long story that goes with it. A, getting his eyes to actually look at me, like my face, above my shoulders, I'll leave it at that, was a novel.
It's not his fault.
I was much better looking back then, I have to say. But and B, was the question he asked was if I knew how to type.
Ooh. Well, that's a really interesting statement, you know, because it turns out that my aunt, she got a law degree way, way back when, like in the 40s. She's in her 80s now. And she said that was the thing that people were asking her all the time. She was Phi Beta Kappa, and she got a law degree. It was very unusual for women, and people asked if she could type. And she always said, "No, I can't type."
Yeah, that was my immediate answer. I looked at the guy and said, no, I can't type. And he goes, well, you know, we have to use computer keyboards a lot. And I said, oh, I can keyboard. I can't type.
There's a difference. There's a huge difference.
Well, it was also a lie. I knew perfectly well how to type. I sure as hell wasn't going to type his reports, though.
Well, it's fun. I'll date myself. I graduated college in 90. But in high school, if you were in the accelerated math program, you had to take typing because computers are becoming so important.
Oh, yeah. My son had to take typing as a, you know, in the lab. He graduated from high school in 2005. But it just, and everyone was required to take typing in eighth grade. Men, girls and boys alike all had to take typing in my junior high. But the fact that this guy asked me, and I checked with my buddies who had also interviewed there, and he didn't ask any of them if they knew how to type.
Well, and you're also talking about interviewing in the early 1980s when, you know, most people who were on keyboards were not on computer keyboards.
That's correct.
Even in the engineering profession.
There were no personal computers. It was all, it was high speed, and those of you old enough to remember, 300 baud audio couple, stick the black phone into the, you know, and then I always had a glass of water next to the little teletype thing because my intimidation factor was to threaten to pour it into its innards if it failed me. It worked usually. You know, computers have a sensor when you're hyper and need something in a hurry, so you have to learn to be calm in front of them. But to continue the typing story, I just have to tell this whole loop because you guys will love this. So I get the job. I'm working away. I've been at the job maybe 3 months, and none of the secretaries will type anything for me. It just was a fact of life. And I desperately needed this one report done, and my boss's secretary was out for the day, and it was the only typewriter available. There were only a couple typewriters in the building not assigned to secretaries. And I had tried not to let anybody know I typed, but I had to get this done. So I go, and I don't even think about it. I go to her desk, and I sit down, and I load it up, and I'm typing away. And somebody walks up to the desk and stands there. This gentleman walks up, and I don't recognize him. I've only been there about 6 months. And I look up and said, yeah. And he says, is my boss Bill? Is Bill in? And I look kind of shrugged, and I lean, you know, I'm on the little roller chair, and I roll around, and I look and go, no, he's not in his office. And that guy goes, then I go back to typing. Then he stands there a little while, and I look up and go, what? And he says, can I leave him a message? So I look around the secretary's desk, and I find one of those little pink while you were out things and a pen. And he starts to dictate it, and I hand it to him and said, you can write it. He's looking at me, and he writes it out, and he tears it off, and he goes to hand it to me. I said, you can stick it on his chair as easy as I can. And I go back to my typing. Not thinking at all about what this looked like. I go back to my desk. Bill never shows up, so he has no idea. I go back to my desk, and I'm working on something. About 2 hours later, Bill walks into my office and says, Margaret, were you at Lois's desk this afternoon? Yeah, how'd you know? And he goes, that explains it. Don't ever sit there again. When he called the guy back with the message, he says, the guy's question was, you had the rudest secretary I've ever met.
and he knew.
Yeah, so after that, I never had to type my own reports.
Okay. Well, I'll calm down in a minute. All right. Who else has got a good funny story?
I told you, Rod, I have more stories.
You know, it's interesting for me because I actually grew up in a rather female-dominated family. My grandmother left her husband, who was beating her, in 1942 and made her way down to South Florida where she worked as an accountant and raised two daughters on her own. And I was always very close to Grandma. But, you know, she got a degree in accounting in 1922, but the whole time she worked in Miami, she was never allowed to sit for the CPA exam.
That's sad. See, now I actually grew up in a male-dominated family. I was the only girl. I was only the second girl in four generations. And what that did was my parents didn't know how to raise a girl. They raised boys. I just happened to look a little different. You know, when I learned how to ride a bike, it was, that a boy? Girl? So,
you know, I had a neighbor when I was going to nuclear power school who was the wife of my best buddy. And Joan was one of eight children. Seven girls, with the last one being a boy. And her dad was an engineer for NASA and was, you know, desperately trying to have a boy. But she used to tell stories about how her dad would get them all out of the car and they would line them up and say, all right, men, let's go.
See, now, when I was baptized, the minister held me up and said, look what happened to Gerton's Home for Boys. And then, and my grandmother was totally distressed because she wanted a girly girl, you know, lace and pink and no. She would give me dolls and I would beat my brothers with them.
That's
it's the only way to defend yourself. I was the youngest. I mean, what was I going to – I needed a weapon. Chatty Cathy with that flywheel, she had good swing, you know.
But see, I didn't have that. I had an older sister and two younger brothers, and my dad was an engineer. But I don't think he expected his daughter to be the nuclear engineer, and none of the other kids went into engineering.
Yeah, same in mine.
My poor dad didn't know what to do. He still doesn't know what to do now either.
Well, I tried raising a nuclear engineer, but she refused to be a nuclear engineer. She's a mechanical engineer. And,
you're close enough.
But she married a nuke, so I think it's okay.
Yeah, my son became a chemical engineer. We're still working on that one.
Well, there's room for chemical engineers. I'll bet you Kirk Sorensen needs a good chemical engineer for his thorium reactors.
Yeah, we're working on it. He's up, and I'll brag on him. He's up at MIT studying lithium air batteries now. But, you know, we'll get there.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, don't go there.
If you're screaming, it's just my daughter.
So, Julie, okay. How old is your daughter?
2 years and 2 months. Kirsten!
Is she typing yet?
Is she what?
Is she typing yet?
Sort of. She has two computers of her own that she can play with, and she knows how to work a mouse. But more importantly, she can work my iPhone apps.
Oh, iPhones. My daughter calls them baby crack. The little kids just love them. They're just pushing the little, you know, icons around with their fingers. It's unbelievable.
So, you know, my son, when we had my son, it was, all we had at the home was a PC Junior. And I programmed it so that if he hit a key, a different random shape and color would come up on the screen. And so he'd sit there and pound on the keys as a toddler and make it do all kinds of bright colors. And he thought that was really cool. I was reminding him of that a few years ago when we went to the exhibit on computers at the American History Museum up in Washington. And I'd worked on every single, all except for the Macs, I'd worked on every single computer in the display.
Wow. That's pretty impressive.
He's like, shut up, Mom.
Well, I have a video of my little girl who's getting married on Saturday typing into a Mac Plus. It's on my Facebook page. She's about 3 years old. And both my girls could type before they could go to elementary school.
Oh, yeah.
Keyboard. I'm sorry. They could both keyboard.
Okay, keyboard. The end of that, the ultimate end of that story after I was the insulting secretary was, and I just have to say this, because this guy, the original guy that asked me if I knew how to type, was renowned as a Neanderthal. Who just, you know, women shouldn't be at work and really didn't respect women. When he retired 10 years later, he actually recommended me to replace him.
Wow.
That's very impressive.
Yeah, I didn't end up getting the job for other political reasons, but when word got out that Frank had recommended Margaret to replace him, there was like this, what the hell did you do?
That's amazing.
I'm damn good at what I do, guys. Just don't go there.
Competence. Competence.
That's right. That's right.
I have a question for you, women in nuclear. This is Gwyneth. Did you find, or have you found, that you had to, like, be twice as good as any of the males you were working with in order to win some kind of respect?
You know, it depended on who.
Yeah,
for me,
exactly.
Anyway. The guys my own age, interestingly enough, the guys my own age, yes, I had to be better, twice as good as them. But the guys that were my dad's age, they just wanted people that did good work. And I didn't get a lot of guff from most of them. But the guys my own age, if I got a promotion, it wasn't because I deserved it, unless I was just twice as good as they were and there was no question.
Wow.
It was a sad thing, but true.
I did find it was about things quite as explicitly as that. For me, it was more that, for example, if we'd all been in an off-site meeting and the cars were forming up to go back to the main building, somehow or other, I ended up driving alone, you know. Everybody ended up in cars with each other. There was a feeling that I was sort of the outsider, no matter what was going on. But I didn't feel that I had to be twice as good as anybody to be accepted. As a matter of fact, I felt it was irrelevant how good I was. But that is perhaps not the best way to look at the world.
Yeah, there was one of the differences was one of the issues, I guess, was that the company was prone to wanting to promote women into leadership positions for their numbers to sort of justify that they weren't biased. And they would promote women who weren't ready.
And
so then what happened was when those of us that came along that were just flat good at what we did and deserved the promotion, they were reluctant to promote us. So I watched women get into leadership positions when I was a young engineer that I knew weren't ready for the job, and they failed. And that set up women can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first nuclear power plant I worked with was Millstone Point 1 in Connecticut. And the story here, another Margaret story. They sent me out to go to the plant, and then I worked at GE. GE had a policy that the first time you went to a nuclear plant, you had to go with someone who'd been there before. Good idea. You know, make sure you don't get yourself busted at the gate. And so the guy I went with, we're on the plane. It's an intercontinental flight, so I get to fly business class. This is back in 1981, 82. And the stewardess, the flight attendant, I can't believe I said that, knocked one of those little bottles of wine into my briefcase. So I got to spend the whole trip smelling like a really bad winery, which was not a winner. But the Millstone Point people were very blunt. They had hired a woman for a position at the plant, and she had failed miserably because she didn't know how to be one of the guys. She couldn't dress out. She couldn't deal with the plant site. And they were not happy that GE had assigned a woman to be their core management engineer and do all their core designs and rod patterns and operating plans. And I had to be absolutely better than anybody for them to go, you know, we're kind of glad we have her. It was very frustrating because it was a little bit of the Navy and Rod, no offense against the Navy, but, you know, Rickover was not real big on women.
Really?
He you know, they could teach, but he was going to be damned if they were going to be on one of his boats.
Mm-hmm.
We just now, this year, accessed the first women into submarines.
Yeah.
There's eight of them, isn't there?
Yeah.
Rod, is there eight?
Eight or nine.
Yeah, I remember, the current admiral. What's his name?
Is the one in charge of naval reactors?
Yeah.
He had asked me that.
He made that announcement last summer at the Women in Nuclear National Conference in Seattle. That was a big deal to make that announcement.
You know,
two of them came from North Carolina State.
Well, North Carolina State's got a great nuclear program.
Yep, I got my master's there. I can say that.
My son was when he went to NC State for his undergraduate, and I had Turinsky chasing him around,
tried to get him into the nuclear program. He finally called me. Yeah, he called me and said, call him off, Mom. I'm not joining it.
Yeah, my daughter actually told me that one of the reasons she decided not to go nuclear was because the submarine force wouldn't allow him to go. And she said, I don't really want to be on an aircraft carrier. They're just way too big. And I said, okay, I can buy that. But you know what the first ship she went to was?
What? What's that?
It wasn't an aircraft carrier, but it was the Iwo Jima, which is darn near as big. It's one of the large amphibious flat decks. So, anyway.
Yeah. See, back in 81, Rickover was still in control. And the Navy approached me. They kind of wanted me to join. And I looked at him and said, I'm not going to teach. I'm not going to do that. I want to do something real. And you're asking me to be not who I want to be. Yeah. And, yeah, we got into big arguments.
Well, Naval Reactors has some very talented women there. They have a pretty active women in nuclear group there. I think I probably counted about half a dozen at a Washington ANS meeting that had a women in nuclear gathering at a happy hour.
At Tumos, the sushi place?
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. We're going to be doing that again this fall.
That's where I met you, isn't it, Julie? What's that?
You're going to join us this fall and come over to, I think it's called Tumos or Tumos, something like that, the sushi place in D.C.?
Sure.
Yeah, sure. That's Women in Nuclear D.C. chapter hosts that.
Yeah, my daughters, you know, kind of laugh at me that I joined Women in Nuclear, but then they realize that I've always kind of been a ladies' man. And they say, in a very good way, Daddy.
Well, you might be surprised to know, I mean, Women in Nuclear, there's 4,200 members. And about 90% of that is women. You know, 10% are men. ANS has 11,000 members, and only 11% are women. There's more women in Women in Nuclear, and it's only been in existence for 11 years, versus the American Nuclear Society, which has been in existence now for, over 60 years?
Well, the nice thing about that fact is when you go to American Nuclear Society meetings, there's never a line at the ladies' room.
That's true. If you go to a women's nuclear meeting, though, we just convert the men's room into a women's room.
Yeah, I went to two WIN meetings. I was at the meeting in Vegas in 2002, and I was in, I think it was Pittsburgh in 2006 or 7.
Yeah, Pittsburgh was a good meeting.
Yeah, that was a good meeting.
I think that was where they lost my clothes.
There's got to be a story
women.
There.
Not a good one.
There are a lot of women in nuclear who don't belong to the ANS. When I was actually, I've only joined the ANS in the past few years. When I was active in the nuclear industry, I was a member of the NACE, National Association of Corrosion Engineers, and at NACE meetings, they had many sessions on corrosion in nuclear materials and nuclear life extension and so forth and so on. At that time, the ANS seemed sort of irrelevant to the work I was doing, and I think that it may be that there's some groups of people that think of ANS as their natural professional society, and others who are working in the industry who don't think of it that way.
No, I think the ANS went through a period of time where it got very academic. And so those of us that were out working in industry, it was like, you aren't relevant. You're really not dealing with the real issues of the industry. And there was a level of not really working in the real, they didn't want to be politically active either. And so there was just like, well, so why am I paying the money to be a member? I wasn't a member. I was chapter vice president at Iowa State, was a member for several years at GE. And then it was kind of like, well, I'm paying this money and I'm really not getting anything out of it. And I quit. I dropped it for a long time. And then when I came out, when I became a higher level manager at GE, I joined again to keep up on the news.
And ANS meetings are also very expensive.
Yeah.
Well, they are, but I think they're trying to turn a corner. There are several working groups now, and they've engaged, I can tell you from personal experience, they're trying to engage younger people, which is scary. They consider me younger. But they are trying to reach out, and I know the utility working group is trying to better understand what do the plants need, what do the utilities need, what are the issues, and how can ANS help. They're trying to reach out to national laboratories because a lot of the national laboratories are the same way. What value are you to us?
Well, you know, you look at they gave up a lot of the like the standards. ASME owns the QA standard and a number of the other N stamps and nuclear standards that ANS should have controlled. So it became somewhat irrelevant. And they are changing that. They are reaching out, and they've made a lot of differences in the last maybe 5 years. You know, those of us that are on the blogger gang, right, we're clearly seeing much more communication out there, which I think is a good thing.
Well, I think a lot of it is the NAYGN is really giving everybody a run for the money.
Absolutely. I'm a member of that group, too, without qualifying for it either. So.
Yeah, well, I remember when they set the age limit, I was already too old.
They actually, when I was still at GE, I was an honorary member because they felt I didn't act my age.
There you go.
When they formed that group, I was already too old, but I joined anyway.
You and me, brother. You and me.
Well, we graduated the same year, Margaret, so I...
Yeah, I know. But I'm not admitting to it. I was a child.
Yeah, that's what I'm always saying, you know, it gets harder and harder, you know, even describing myself as an Appalachian child bride just doesn't work by the time you're a grandmother like I am, you know. People know you're older.
Yeah.
Well, I had to laugh, Rod. Did you go to the talent management session at the Region 2 conference where they talked about the double hump in a woman's career?
Yes.
In her 30s, she stops and has kids, and then she steps out, and I'm going, 30s? I didn't have my first till 40. What does that do to my curve?
Well, I don't know about you, but when I saw that curve, I immediately said, the fission yield curve.
That's what I said, too. Well, we call that May West.
Well, yeah, so did we.
Well, we learned that at RPI. That's what the professors called it, was the May West curve.
Yep.
Yep, so did my professors at Iowa State.
But, you know,
it's interesting
that my career actually matched that.
Really?
Yes. I actually had two careers in the Navy because I was active duty until I was 33 years old, and I resigned my commission and went to try to be an entrepreneur, but also so I could work out of the house. And I did that from 1993 until 1999 and went back in the Navy. So that was the time when my daughters were at an age where I really wanted to have an influence on them. And it seemed to work.
I said, I don't get a break. When I had Kirsten, I had just gotten the Californian program restarted, and they held it for me. They didn't take it away. So I jumped back into that. Then 9 months later, I ruptured my Achilles, so I was out another 6 weeks. Went through that. They didn't take it away, and they just keep adding more.
You're good. You're good. They don't want to lose you. Yeah.
But we're fortunate. We have an awesome daycare that's more like a school, where she actually is learning, and I feel comfortable letting her be there for 9 to 10 hours a day.
Yeah, my granddaughter has an exceptional nanny. I don't know how my daughter and son-in-law found her, but actually I do know how they found her, but she's a really neat lady, a former school teacher, and just loves being with a baby. So it works out well, because Danica doesn't work 8-hour days either.
No, none of us work 8-hour days anymore.
So, you know, one of the things I have noticed that you talk about the membership at ANS as being not terribly large focused towards women, but it seems to me the attendance at ANS meetings and the leadership at ANS has an awful lot of representation for a male-dominated organization.
Well, if you looked, those are also much younger women, aren't they?
There's some aggressive younger women, yes. Yes.
We've got graduate students that are running sessions now.
Yeah. I was very impressed by the graduate student who spoke. What was her name?
Shaheen.
Shaheen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's terrific. She did a very...
Yeah, but the graduate students we're seeing now, Rachel Slaba is at Wisconsin, and Rachel heads up student at the ANS National level, the student committee.
Mm-hmm.
And she's also very active on the MEAD committee, and she's active in the Professional Women of ANS. And she's still working on her PhD and holds, you know, executive board positions in those committees.
Yep.
And Michaela Eddy is another one who I think either just recently graduated.
I know Michaela just did a internship in D.C. I think I met her at the student conference last year. Very, very bright and an amazing leader. She was pretty much in charge of that conference.
I mean, there's just several of them that are coming up that are, you know, 23, 24 years old, and they command.
So when you're talking to young ladies about a career in nuclear, what are some of the things that you tell them about the profession and about, you know, balance and that kind of stuff?
Oh, balance? There is none. Sorry, there isn't a balance.
Yeah, I was not very impressed, but I have to be honest, I was not very impressed by the TVA executive who basically said, yep, I made it where I am by just moving whenever I needed to move and just yanking my family along with me.
Yeah, sadly, there's truth there. You know, of course, I worked for a huge corporation, which meant not only was it just the imbalance of nuclear, but it was when they want you to be somewhere, you're there. Balance, you know, I've always, my comment to my son is you have to pick what you want to be. And if your career, you know, you can have so much balance in your life, but you have to give up to do things, and you have to decide what's important and what's not, and do what's important. So if having the house clean isn't so important, then don't have a clean house, you know, but you got to pick it. And the people who say, well, it's all about balance and it's all about juggling things and deciding, it's like, well, but guys, there's still only 24 hours in the day. And you have to decide what matters and what doesn't and go for it from there.
Yeah, like I pick up my daughter. That's my responsibility. And I have to leave work at 4:30.
Yep.
And I'm very adamant with the bosses. I leave at 4:30.
Yep. And I did the same thing when my son was little, and I said, I looked my boss square in the eye, and I said, and it was 1987 and 88 and 89, and so working from home was a lot trickier. I said, I will figure out how to make that happen, but I have to leave this place at 5 o'clock because I got to pick him up and I got to be home. And, you know, I made it work. I said either, you know, I was very, very efficient in the 8 hours or 9 hours I was at the office, and then I did what I needed to do at home. But balance is such a, what is balance is part of the problem. It's an easy thing to say, work-life balance. I don't know what that means. It's always, for me, it was what was important.
And it changes. I mean, that's what everyone keeps telling me. It's going to be different now that she's little, but when she's older, it'll change again.
Right. And trust me, it doesn't get any lower in amount of hours because you don't want to miss those things either. You know.
Well, I am fortunate. My babysitter also cleans house. So we go out once a month. She comes in during the day, cleans the whole house. We come home, she feeds the daughter dinner, and my husband and I go out.
Yep. Nope. And that was one of our things, is we couldn't afford it. But I said, we're going to get somebody to clean the house, because I was spending every Saturday cleaning house.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I don't want my son remembering. And this is when I was just a low-level engineer and couldn't really afford it. I looked at my husband and said, I do not want my son remembering his childhood as being when he saw his mom, she had a mop in her hand. You know, and I'm enough of a nutcase. I got all kinds of things I'd rather be doing than cleaning house. And so we said, you know, this is important enough that we'll eat peanut butter and jelly more often so that somebody else cleans the house so that we can go out and I can be at the T-ball games and we can go play in the park and we can do whatever it is that we want to be doing so that he has those experiences. And
there's very few things more important than going to the T-ball games.
Yeah, especially watching your son picking the dandelions on the left field.
I watched my daughter turn cartwheels in the right field.
Oh, God. Yeah. And then the crazy parents on the other side, your son's out. He has to get off. And it's like, it's T-ball. Get a grip. Oh, yeah. Those were the days. Anyway, but I, you know, my comment to young men and women, I don't really distinguish that because I have the same words for my son, is you really have to look at it and decide what's important. And decide, and at work, a lot of it is looking at it, saying, "Is it going to matter 5 years from now? If I am I turning myself inside out over something that really doesn't matter today?"
And one of the things that I do advocate, or at least tell people to think about, is I'm very happy that we ended up having kids early, because I'm enjoying the heck out of being a professional, not having young kids in around. My youngest daughter's 26, so it's worked for me.
Yeah, I had my kids in my 20s also. That seemed to work out okay for me.
Nah, I waited till 8. It's actually easier now because my husband and I are a little bit more laid back, and he actually does his half of raising her. He's amazing with taking care of her, so that makes it easier. And I'm not sure he would have done that in his 30s. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I have to admit, the other lucky thing in my life was that my husband was comfortable with being the stay-at-home parent. He couldn't clean house, and that was our one battle. But when my son turned about 4 or 5, he was about starting kindergarten, my husband got laid off, and we looked at each other and said, "Don't know that we can really afford this, but I think you need to stay home." And he agreed. I always made more money. And it just was the right thing. Now, living here on the when we moved to North Carolina, we've been here twice. And the first time we moved here, there was a lot of problems with that. People just couldn't believe my husband stayed home. That just was wrong. Oh, yeah. That just went against nature.
My husband did something similar. He had been working at a regular job, and he'd gotten some consulting on the side. And then I'd been working at a regular job, and then I got this EPRI job. And the EPRI job, really, I had to travel about 1 week a month, and sometimes more. You're always either going to an EPRI meeting, or you're going to see with the contractors, it was just endless. And he stopped his regular job and just stayed home and did consulting. He earned a reasonable amount of money, but I don't think he really earned as much as he had at his job. But he was like, well, somebody's got to be there. And I was traveling too much. So that was something that he did. And I think it was good for the whole family. I didn't even appreciate it enough at the time, because part of it was that I had plane tickets in my purse so often that I would often have a couple of plane tickets, you know, for a couple of trips in advance. I mean, I used to carry big purses.
So, Julie, you're one of the, what I call, almost the lost generation.
Yeah, I'm at low dip in the curve.
What really attracted you to nuclear engineering in 1990?
Well, I graduated college in 90. It was 1986 when I was in high school. I had a chance.
That's the same year that Chernobyl blew up.
Yeah, it was, and Challenger and all that other good stuff. But the summer before my senior year of high school, you get inundated with all that college information. Lynchburg College in Virginia had a summer program where you went down there for a week, and they had 13 different courses you could choose from, and one of them was nuclear chemistry. And I was getting ready to take AP Chemistry and Calculus my senior year, so I thought, oh, that looks pretty cool. My parents said, okay, yep, packed up the camper, and they drove me from upstate New York down to Lynchburg College, dropped me off, and said, see you in a week, and they went off and had fun. Me, on the other hand, took classes all morning, and nuclear chemistry was the only one that had a lab in the afternoon on the fourth floor of this building that had no air conditioning. But I loved it. We did parent-daughter decay. We did separations. I learned about Glenn Seaborg. And I just came back and told my dad, I'm going to be a nuclear engineer. But you have to, you know, I grew up in the shadows of Kesselring. We had 4 nuclear reactors, you know, 20 miles away. I had Knowles Atomic Power Lab down the road. So nuclear was familiar to us where I grew up.
So you saw the big dig ball, huh?
Yes, I saw Mars, yes. That place scared the living daylights out of me.
Well, no, the ball was not Marf. The ball was Dig.
Oh, that was D1J?
Yep.
All I know is there were guards that had MPD on their armbands and big rifles in their arms. And I told the guy I was dating at the time, never again am I picking you up here. But no, I mean, I just fell in love with nuclear chemistry, and I knew I wanted to be an engineer because I was good at math and science. So it made it easy, and plus it made it easy when there was only one nuclear engineering school in New York, and that was RPI. So I made it easy, too, to decide where to go to school.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you must have not had too much, I don't know. How big was the program there at RPI at that time?
We had eight in my class, and three of us were women. So we had the best odds I think they ever saw. And what's really
I have
cool
a question. Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, it's okay. I was just going to say last year, one of the other women in my class, we both got represented in the alumni magazine. She was in Air Force and was doing the C-130s down in Antarctica, and I got recognized for the awards from ANS and WIN. So it was really neat to see the two of us back-to-back, class of 90 nuclear engineering, you know, two women.
I've
noticed that the nuclear engineering departments in general are tending to have more women than they did back in the dark ages when I went to school.
Do you think that is going to change women, you know, in surveys of the public tend to be more anti-nuclear than men or more scared about nuclear power. Do you think having more women in the field could somehow make a difference?
Absolutely.
And the part two of my question is, when you're out mingling with just women in other walks of life and they find out that you're a nuclear engineer, do you have any kind of discussion with them where they say, oh, I'm afraid of that, or I don't want my kids near a nuclear plant, or how do you handle that? I'm thinking of this because of a nuclear engineer, a woman who spoke at a women's focus group I attended in New York City, and she said, I'm a nuclear engineer. I have gone through three pregnancies while working at a nuclear plant, and my children are normal. In fact, they're above average. So I'd throw that out, like, how do you interact with women who might be skeptical about nuclear power?
Yeah, that's actually a pretty good question. It depends a bit on which part of the country I was living in at the time. Here in Wilmington, where I live now, you have Brunswick Nuclear Power Plant right across the river and GE Fuel Manufacturing Plant right up the road. So people here either know people who work there or worked there themselves, or at any rate, they're more familiar and therefore more comfortable. So you don't get a lot of, ooh, ah, you're a scary person. The first part of my career, however, with GE, I lived in California, Northern California, Bay Area, where nuclear is the devil's spawn, I guess, is a good way to describe how I was viewed at times.
That's a pretty good way to describe it. I lived in Palo Alto.
At EPRI, you would be familiar with that. So I actually sometimes didn't admit to who I was and what I did because I was just too tired to have the argument. An argument was the only way to describe it. And my usual stance was to say, well, what are you afraid of? And let's just talk about it. And a lot of times people would say, you know, you're kind of a cool person for a nuke. You know, and I said, well, you know, we are real people. We're not the devil's spawn. I was very passionate about the economy, the ecology and the economy when I became a nuclear engineer. I did this because I feel that it is a good green option. And when people, I tried to join the Sierra Club when I lived in California. I got kicked out.
They didn't take you, did they?
Nope, they kicked me out. They found out I was a nuclear engineer at GE and
they kicked
me out.
They kicked you
out? Yep, they gave me back my money and told me never to come back.
Really?
Yep.
That's amazing.
Yep.
No, because I quit the Sierra Club when I was in California. I was in it for a while, and at that point I wasn't in nuclear. I was in geothermal, and I discovered that I thought, you know, geothermal, you know, they have the geysers there and they have other things. I thought it was so great because, and I still do, because the entire power cycle is on the whatever acres of land you've got with the wells and the power plants and the reinjection. I mean, the entire thing, it's right there. It's fabulous. And they were fighting them. They were fighting developing them. They, you know, we like geothermal, but not just not this geothermal. We like renewable, but just not this one.
I quit. Yeah, and that's kind of my goal had been to try to change them from the inside, to become a member and to be that humanizing force. But sort of back to your original question about what do you say to women? When they find out I'm a nuke, there's two reactions. One is, ooh, you must be really, really smart.
You are.
And I love to hear that, you know, and I like to sort of buff my knuckles on my shirt and say, oh yeah, I'm brilliant. And I usually tell them, no, I'm actually just very stubborn. And studying hard gets you through. But it's that when you put that human element on it, it just changes the way people think. It's really interesting because when they go, you're a real person and you're in nuclear, and they'll say things like, well, I'm afraid of the radiation. And it's like, well, you know, I can tell you funny stories. My son is brilliant. And I, by the way, walked through the beam of the reactor, the test reactor at Iowa State during lab when I didn't realize they had the tube open and it hit about waist high. And I have a very brilliant son, so maybe it did good things. I don't know.
Hey, ladies and Rod, I apologize. It's 8 o'clock.
Okay,
it's
Julie.
Dead time. She's crying.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for coming and chatting with us. I appreciate it. And I'll see you soon.
Yes, and I appreciate the invite. So anytime.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You know, but, you know, there's no magic. I think it's just a matter of by being a human being in the industry, it just changes. It has a tendency to make people think differently.
You know, one of the things that I really want to have people start thinking about is a lot of women who fight nuclear say they're doing it because they're afraid of the legacy that we're leaving behind. And that's, to me, one of the absolute reasons that I fight for nuclear, because I would certainly rather leave behind some nicely stored raw materials for future generations than to burn up all of the methane gas that the world has stored up over hundreds of millions of years.
And also, you know, sometimes I just say, so what's going to happen to the coal ash ponds? Nobody really seems to have an answer for that one.
You know, well, and yeah, I ask those same questions about the waste from solar panels and windmill blades and every other waste, you know, computers and, you know,
batteries.
And my son and I have had that discussion. sorry.
179 million tons a year of batteries are thrown into landfills.
And are permanently toxic.
And
that's usually the point I try to make is, yes, it's radioactive. Yeah, you don't want to stand right next to a hot bundle for a long time. This probably wouldn't be good for your health. But it's not any more dangerous than any other human-generated waste. And it's not waste if you think about it correctly. And just like a lot of the other stuff we just throw into landfills and throw into garbage dumps, it can be recycled and used again. And if you do that, the remainder is small. It's actually more volatile. It decays quicker. And then that's part of the other part of the conversation is, well, it's going to be dangerous for 100,000 years. And you get into this, no. There's regulation and there's real danger. And the slower the isotope decays, the less dangerous it actually is. And trying to get people to understand that it's a different, you got to get calm down and let's have a conversation.
Yep. Well, ladies, I thank you very much for joining me tonight for an one of the best belly laughs I've had in a long time.
Always think of me as a secretary.
I can just think of you as a rude secretary. I'm sorry, Mark.
Thank you. That's a high compliment.
I'm sorry. But anyway, well, thanks to you, and we'll have to do this again sometime soon. So for the Atomic Show, good night. And it's a wonderful time to be a nuke.
Amen, brother.
All right.
Yeah. Thank you. A pleasure.
A pleasure. Bye-bye, Rod.
Bye.
Bye.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way.